Well, I'm going to turn my mic on. Sorry. Hello? Can you hear me? Is it on? All right. Whether you were really, really happy a couple days ago or really sad a couple days ago, there's a quote by one of the guys I like. It's fitting that we just sing that song. He said, "God bless America, so that we may be a blessing to the hurting, to the poor, to the vulnerable, to the immigrants, to the oppressed, to the marginalized. God bless America." And that was pretty fitting. We've been going through the book of John. I'm so back if you've not been here a couple weeks. I'm the new guy. We've been going through the book of John. And so far we've looked at the prologue, which is what you need to know before the story gets started, so that John can tell his story. Then we looked at the calling of some of Jesus' disciples and focused on Nathanael, the skeptical disciple. And we talked about how being a skeptic is okay. God came for the skeptics. Jesus came for the skeptics. And that's good for us now, as we have become a very skeptical society, have we not? And today we're going to look at this interesting story. It's the first miracle, if you will, and it all takes place at a wedding. Now, Heather and I had an awesome wedding. It was great. Now, you have to understand this. Now, in Syracuse, what usually happens is like July rolls around and snow starts coming, right? And it snows for like till like June, and so you have like 2 weeks of like nice weather, and then like everything else is snow covered, right? It's the snowiest city in America, like over 110 inches of snow a year. Like, it's just crazy, right? So January 12th, our wedding day, God sets the stage, and it's 65 degrees outside. The sun's shining, and the heavens opened. An angelic choir said, "Ah!" I mean, it was one of those things, right? I was just like, "This is crazy! Like, 65 degrees in the beginning of January is nuts." But it was awesome, and I'll show you this video. Oh, I don't have a video because I kind of messed that up. One of my youth group kids was supposed to. She was in college at that point. She was supposed to record our wedding, and then. Somehow she didn't do that, and so now there's no documented evidence of a wedding happening. But there's some pictures, right? That's a pretty good kiss. I mean, I think I did. I nailed that one. And so the photographer told us all to be like really funny in that picture, which I think, except for if you look at Heather's mom, she's like still like being serious. She's like smiling, like, and like everybody else is going nuts, right? But she's just like. What's everybody doing? Anyway, so I loved our wedding. Our wedding was perfect. It was in this little country church, and it was just beautiful, and everything worked out right, and it was just awesome. I kind of screwed up the honeymoon, and not that we went to the Dominican Republic, which was awesome, right? And it was January in Syracuse, so we're like, we're gonna go where it's really warm, and so we. We went, but the problem was I booked it, and I'm like, well, I want to get the most bang out of my buck. So I scheduled a flight for us at 7:30 in the morning the next day after our, you know, just the biggest day of our life, right? And Heather's like, "What, you did what?" You do realize that we're going to be totally exhausted. And I was like, oh. That's why you're smart and I'm not. But anyway, regardless of that, we went to the Dominican Republic and had an awesome time, and it was awesome and fun. So, the whole thing, this whole first miracle of Jesus, it takes place at a wedding. Let's read this. John chapter 2, 1 through 12. The next day, Jesus' mother was a guest at a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee. Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. The wine supply ran out during the festivities, so Jesus' mother spoke to him about the problem. "They have no more wine," she told him. "How does that concern you and me?" Jesus asked. "My time has not yet come." But his mother told the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." 6 stone water pots were standing there. They were used for Jewish ceremonial purposes, and they held 20 to 30 gallons each. Jesus told the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And when the jars had been filled to the brim, he said, dip some out and take it to the master of the ceremonies." So they followed the instructions. And when the master of the ceremonies tasted the water that was now wine, not knowing where it had come from, though of course the servants knew, he called the bridegroom over. "Usually a host serves the best wine first," he said, "and then when everyone is full and doesn't care, he brings out the less expensive wines. But you have kept the best till now." This miraculous sign at Cana in Galilee was Jesus' first display of his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After the wedding, he went to Capernaum for a few days with his mother, his brother, and his disciples. So there's lots to go over here, lots to digest, right? First off, let me tell you this about the proper way to read your Bible or study the Bible or whatever. The first principle of biblical interpretation, the first principle of how to study the Bible, is that when you read a story, you don't read it as if it were today. Right? That makes sense? You read it as if it were written for the people that it was written for. Right? So, this very story was written for people that didn't know God or didn't know who Jesus really was, but yet people that were first century people, right? So this was a first century audience that is being written to. And the whole purpose of the book of John was so that people might believe. Okay? So that makes sense? So we don't read it and go, "Huh, I wonder what this means to me." Instead, we read it and go, "Huh, I wonder what this means to the people that it was written to." And then after we figure that out, we say, "Well, how does that apply to me?" I don't know if that made any sense. Head nod? Okay. So, with that in mind, we have to look at the weddings, what weddings meant back in the first century. Weddings were like a huge deal. And they were all about, actually, it was more about community than it was about the actual bride and bridegroom. Does that make sense? So, like, the bigger the wedding, the more people that came, and the more upstanding it was better for the community because it built a stronger community, and the stronger community could then stand together. And so, like, just weddings were just this huge deal. And I can't imagine, the reception lasted up to a week, right? Which is crazy. That's just a crazy thought. Like, our wedding was really expensive, even though we totally went cheap with everything. It was still really expensive. I cannot imagine this reception, our reception, lasting 6 more days on top of what we paid. You know, we're like, that would be crazy town, right? And so, but that's what it was. Like, these people, they would go and they would expect 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days worth of a party. And I can't imagine that, but that's how it was. And wedding celebrations, they lasted up to a week. And unlike today, weddings were not religious ceremonies. Instead, they were civil contracts. So, a groom's parents would pay the bride's family in an agreement that their children would be married at some day when they were grown. So, like, it'd be like my daughter, Evelyn, and some other 3 or 4, 2, 3, 4 year old, some guy, their mom, coming to us and being like, "Hey, when our kids grew up, we want them to be married." And we're like, "All right, well, how much you got?" And then they'd be like, "How about $75,000? And we'd be like, "Well, let's see if there's any other takers, you know, like, what's going on?" But, like, Because I'll tell you what, Evelyn's worth a lot more than $75,000. I'll just put that. No, but you know, like that was just how it was. It was a civil contract, and it was more. The groom's parents would then pay the bride's family, and they had until they were old enough, up to 7 years later, to fulfill however much they agreed upon. Does that make sense? So, not like today, right? This is not like what we do, okay? And it wasn't until celebrations that bride and groom, that they would live together. It wasn't until the actual ceremony took place, okay? It wasn't until the ceremony took place that they were really married, if you know what I mean, right? That's kind of what happened. So, you know, you could have an engaged couple, and they would be like, you know, well, yeah, I'm engaged. We'll probably get married 6 years, and that's when we'll actually see each other, you know, and stuff like that. So, anyway, the whole town was invited. And we aren't sure, but this may have been a member of Mary's family. We're not sure why Mary feels so responsible for everything. Like why Mary cares that they've run out of wine, right? But we know that running out of wine is a shameful, shameful thing back then. If you ran out of wine, party was over. Because that's what they drank. They drank wine. And if you ran out, they're like, okay. Well, let's take our party favors and go home, right? You know, let's do this. Let's get out of here. But Mary feels really responsible. It's a big boo-boo if you run out of wine. And Mary, like I said, we don't know if it was family or what, but Mary just feels real responsible for making something happen. And so she comes to Jesus. And remember, Mary has treasured all these things in her heart. Remember that, where it says that in the Bible? Like, Mary treasured up all the things that were said about Jesus in her heart, and she remembered them. And so Mary knows who Jesus is. And she knows what he's going to do. She knows that he's God. And she knows that if he would just do something, it could change everything. And so she comes to him and says, Jesus, they ran out of wine. Verses 2 through 5 says this. Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. The wine supply ran out during the festivities, so Jesus' mother spoke to him about the problem. They have no more wine, she told him. How does that concern you and me? Jesus asked. My time has not yet come. But his mother told the servants, do whatever he tells you to do. Mary is expecting Jesus to do something. Anyone else notice the way that Jesus talks to his mom here? My translation is a little nicer than most translations. Does anybody, what does somebody else's translation say? When Jesus said to her, woman? Woman, why is this my problem? I don't know about you, I'm 39 years old. If I talk to my mom like that today, it's big problems. Big, big problems. If I call my mom woman, I got a picture of my mom. So, well, that's not my mom. That is what my mom would use on me when I was, you know, growing up. I remember the day that she never used one of those again. And I don't know why, but she pulled out a wooden spoon, took it to my butt, or bottom, and whap, snapped it in half. And then she grabbed another spoon, whap, snapped it in half, right? So she's like, grabbed another spoon, whap, snapped it in half. And then I made a big mistake, and I started laughing. And then she came back with a backhand across my cheek. I don't think she's ever backhanded me before or ever again, but, like, that hurt. You know, she got the ring, and whap, and I'm like, there's, like, a mark on my face. And I was like, oh, sorry. But I think that today, at 39, if I would have said to my mom, woman, what is your problem? Then my mom would be like, oh yeah, check out this spoon. And magically one would appear. She'd be like, you know, but that's not what happens. There's different reasons that the commentators have. Like, a lot of people try to flower it up and be like, no, it was just Jesus. That's kind of how they talked back then. And that's not true. I think that the response that I most agree with, you guys remember the movie Gladiator? If not, I won't ruin it for you because the movie was from like 15 years ago. If you haven't seen it by now, sorry. But so the end of the movie Gladiator, Russell Crowe fights and kills the guy in the epic battle, and then he dies because he got poisoned. And then you see this guy who's there's an African warrior that him and they were like best friends, and you see him, he's burying some trinkets or whatever that he has that represent the Russell Crowe's family, and he says, "I will see you again, but not yet." And I really think that is what is wrapped up here when Jesus is talking. Jesus knows that the instant he does a miracle, the instant he does a sign, game on. Right? And what does he know happens at the end of the game? Anybody?
He dies.
So here he is, thinking to himself, I don't know. This will be the beginning of his career. There will be no turning back. This will be the point where Jesus goes from son, my son, for Mary, to my God. Jesus will become not Mary's son anymore, but he has now become Mary's God. Does that make sense? He is announcing that whenever he does something miraculous, he is announcing who he is. Where Jesus goes from calling her mom to where he moves into the role of Savior or the sacrificial lamb. He knew that the instant he did something like this, the clock started ticking. I'm sure he was thinking, not yet. I'm not ready yet. Jesus, of course, knew what was going to happen. He knew that he had come to die. He knew that he was a human and that he probably wanted to wait a bit longer. But look what he does, ready or not. 6 stone water pots were standing there. They were used for Jewish ceremonial purposes and held 20 to 30 gallons each. Jesus told the servants, fill the jars with water. When the jars had been filled to the brim, he said, dip some out and take it to the master of the ceremonies. So they followed his instructions. And when the master of the ceremonies tasted the water that was now wine, not knowing where it had come from, though of course the servants knew, he called the bridegroom over and says, usually a host serves the best wine first. He says, and then everybody is full and doesn't care. He brings out the less expensive wine. But you have kept the best until now. I have no idea why he decided to do it. Bible says he was fully human and fully God. Maybe he leaned into his godness and decided the time was right. Maybe he wanted to one last time honor his mother. I don't know, but I think that the first miracle, his calling card, his sign that there's a new sheriff in town is an odd one. Don't you think? His first miracle wasn't curing a blind person. It wasn't curing a lame person. It wasn't raising the dead. It was simply turning water into wine, which is like a parlor trick, like a magician trick. Like, that's it? That's how you're going to just bust into the scene? First, let's zone in here on verse 7 through 9. Jesus is directing, instructing, and ordering the servants in what to do. We don't know what it was like, the miracle. We don't know if all of a sudden, the water, as soon as they started pouring the water in. The water that was being filled up became wine. We don't know that. We don't know if, like, once all the pots were full, that's when the wine water turned into wine. We don't know if once it touched the guy's lips, maybe that's when it turned into wine. All we know is that it happened. And after it was done, Jesus directed a servant to take a glass to the master of the ceremonies. The master of the ceremonies was the head steward, a wedding planner times 10, if you will. Remember, he's got to plan a party for up to 7 days. This is the guy that has to be in charge of an army of servants, directing, instructing, and ordering the servants in what to do. And so he tastes it, and he is amazed. But did you catch what was really important? Do you catch what Jesus is saying? Jesus is saying, for all their paying close attention, I am the master of the ceremonies. I am the Lord of the feast. It is me. From this point on, nothing is going to happen that my Father and I don't want to have happen. Even my death. And yes, there will be death. But even that will be because the Father wills it. And the result in that death will be the most amazing news. News that is truly good. The good news that I can take ordinary water and make it living water. The good news that at some point all of the sadness will be made joy. That all the crying will be turned to laughter. And I am going to set up a new heaven and a new earth. And there will be a huge party. A huge, never-ending feast. One that declares, great are you, Lord, a wedding feast when I come for my bride, that those who know me and love me will all get to go to. It is no accident that this was his first miracle. Jesus is announcing, I am Lord of the feast. I am the master of the ceremonies. I have come to bring joy. That's the reason I've come. That's my calling card. My first miracle is going to set everybody laughing and partying, and full of joy. Real quick, let's not forget one more detail in verse 6. He takes these jars that are used for ceremonial Jewish cleansing, and he directs the servants to fill them up. Here's what one of those jars would look like. It's kind of hard to see, I guess, but it's huge. It's this big, you know, tub of water. 20 to 30 gallons fits in it. The Jewish people had all kinds of rules, rituals, regulations about how you pretty much did everything. They had the moral laws, or the mishpatam, which were like the Ten Commandments. And then there's ceremonial laws. I think there's like 450 ceremonial laws about how to wash this way, or do this thing, or you're clean if you do this, and if you're unclean, then you have to do this to become clean. You have to eat and wash your hands this way, or if you touch a dead animal, you have to wash up this way. All these physical cleaning and purifications pointed to the spiritual need to be clean. The fact that God is holy and perfect, and we are all flawed, and so to connect with him at all, there has to be an atonement, a cleansing, a pardon. So that is what those jars were for. And that is exactly why Jesus used them. He rescues this couple from their humiliation. He has announced to the world that by using these jars, normally used for ceremonial washing, that he has come into the world to accomplish in reality what all of the laws of the Old Testament have been pointing to and what they were for. He has come to clean us up. He has come to purify the world from sin, to take away our burdens and our stains. He is the cleansing water, and once and for all, he has turned it into the best wine. That if we would just come drink from his well, his jar, that we can be connected with God forever. One of my all-time favorite stories, just thinking about parties. I'll read it to you. By this guy named Tony Campolo. I read this book when I was a sophomore in high school, so it's old. But Tony Campolo is one of my favorite authors. And he told a story about, he's a preacher, he'd go around, travel, speak. He was also a professor. He tells a story about this one night in Honolulu, Hawaii. Up a side street, I found a little place that was still open. I went in, took a seat on one of the stools at the counter, and waited to be served. This was one of those sleazy places that deserves the name Greasy Spoon. I mean, I did not even touch the menu. I was afraid that if I opened the thing, something gruesome would crawl out of it. But it was the only place I could find open at 3:30 in the morning. So the guy behind the counter came over and asked me, "What do you want?" I told him a cup of coffee and a donut. He poured a cup of coffee, wiped his grimy hand on his smudged apron, then grabbed a donut off the shelf behind him. I'm a realist. I know that in the back room of that restaurant, donuts probably dropped on the floor and kicked around. But when everything is out in front where I could see it, I really would have appreciated it if he would have used a pair of tongs or some wax paper. But I sat there, munching on my donut, sipping my coffee at 3:30 in the morning. The door of the diner suddenly swung open, and to my discomfort, in marched 8 or 9 provocative and boisterous prostitutes. It was a small place, and they sat on either side of me. Their talk was loud and crude. I felt completely out of my element, out of place. And I was just about to make my getaway when I overheard the woman sitting beside me say, "Tomorrow's my birthday. I'm going to be 39. Her friend responded in a nasty tone, "So what do you want from me? A birthday party? What do you want? You want me to get you a cake and sing happy birthday?" "Come on," said the woman next to me. "Why do you have to be so mean? I was just telling you, that's all. Why do you have to always put me down? I was just telling you it was my birthday. I don't want anything from you. I mean, why should you give me a birthday party? I've never had a birthday party in my whole life. Why should I have one now?" And when I heard that, I made a decision. I sat and I waited until the woman had left. Then I called over the guy behind the counter and I asked him, "Do they come in here every night?" "Yeah," he answered. "The one right next to me, does she come here every night?" "Yeah, that's Agnes. She comes in here every night. What do you want to know?" "Because I heard her say that tomorrow's her birthday. What do you think about throwing a birthday party for her right here tomorrow night?" A smile slowly crossed his chubby face, and he answered with a measured delight, "That's great. I like it. That's a great idea." Calling to his wife, who did the cooking in the back room, he shouted, "Hey, come out here. This guy's got a great idea. Tomorrow's Agnes's birthday. This guy wants to go in with him and throw a birthday party for her right here, tomorrow night." His wife came out in the back room, all bright and smiley. She said, "That's wonderful. You know, Agnes is one of those people who's really nice and kind, and nobody ever does anything nice for her. Look," I told him, "if that's okay with you, I'll get back tomorrow night or tomorrow morning about 2:30 and decorate the place. I'll even get a birthday cake." "No way," said Harry. "The birthday cake's my thing. I'll make it." At 2:30 the next morning, I was back at the diner. I had picked up some crepe paper decorations at the store and made a sign out of big pieces of cardboard that read, "Happy Birthday, Agnes." I decorated the diner from one end to the other. I had the diner looking good. The woman who did the cooking must have gotten the word out on the street, because by 3:15, every prostitute in Honolulu was in the place. It was wall-to-wall prostitutes and me. At 3:30 on the dot, the door of the diner swung open, and in came Agnes and her friend. I had everybody ready. I was kind of the MC, after all. And when they all came in, we all screamed, "Happy birthday!" Never have I seen a person so flabbergasted, so stunned, so shaken. Her mouth fell open. Her legs seemed to buckle a bit. Her friend grabbed her arm to steady her. As she was led to one of the stools along the counter wall, we all sang happy birthday. As we came to the end of the singing, her eyes moistened. Then when the birthday cake came out with all the candles on it, she lost it. Harry gruffled, mumbling, "Blow out the candles, Agnes. Come on, blow out the candles. If you don't blow out the candles, I'm going to blow them out myself." After an endless few seconds, he did. Then he handed her a knife and told her, "Cut the cake, Agnes. We all want some cake." Agnes looked down at the cake. Then without taking her eyes off of it, she slowly and softly said, "Look, Harry, is it all right with you? Is it okay if, what I want to ask, is it okay if I keep the cake a little bit? Do we have to eat it right away?" Harry shrugged and said, "Sure, it's okay. If you want to keep the cake, keep the cake. Take it home if you want." "Can I?" she said. Then she looked at me smiling. "I live just down the street, a couple of doors. I'll take the cake home and show it to my mom. I'll come right back." So she got off the stool, picked up the cake, and carrying it like she was carrying the Holy Grail, she walked down toward the door. As we all stood there motionless, she said, she left. And when the cake door closed, there was a stunned silence in the place. Not knowing what else to do, I broke the silence by saying, "What do you say we pray?" Looking back now, it seems more than strange that a professor and preacher would be leaving a prayer meeting with a bunch of prostitutes in a diner in Honolulu at 3:30 in the morning. But it just felt like the right thing to do. I prayed for Agnes, and I prayed for her salvation. I prayed that her life would be changed and that God would be good to her. And when she finished, when I finished, Harry leaned over the counter and said, "Hey, you never told me you were a preacher. What kind of church do you belong to?" In one of those moments, the words that were just right came. I said, "I belong to a church that throws birthday parties for prostitutes at 3:30 in the morning." Harry waited a moment and said, "No, you don't. There's no church like that. If a church was that, like that, I'd join that church." Church. What else is there? We have the words of life. We have the opportunity to bless people and to invite them to a never-ending party, a never-ending feast, a never-ending celebration. We have the ability to give them Jesus. What are we waiting for? Do you love them? He loves you. I don't know where you are today,